From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. One of the summer's most praised new novels is Heat Signature, a West Coast noir that starts in a California desert shantytown. You'll meet author Lisa Teasley today on Insight. Also today, it's not just computers that are vulnerable to hackers. A local scientist finds a surprising way to attack a cell phone via the web. Plus, you often hear how similar chimps and humans are genetically, but some parts of the human genome have raced ahead. A Davis researcher helped uncover one. And a tough break for Zin, a popular wine that gets no special treatment from the governor. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, new research finds one part of the human genome that's evolved quickly and well beyond its equivalent in chimpanzees. Also, a fiendish way to attack cell phones. And bad news for Zinfandel at the state capitol. Governor Schwarzenegger exercises his veto. First, a new novel by a California writer has gotten great reviews this summer. The book is Heat Signature. It's a West Coast noir about a man in a Southern California desert town haunted by the murder of his mother. The author is Lisa Teasley. She's a California native, lives in Los Angeles. Heat Signature is just her third book and her second novel. The first book was an award-winning collection of short stories. Lisa Teasley's on a book tour. She's in Sacramento today with a signing this evening. First, she's in our studio. Lisa Teasley, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much for having me here, Jeffrey.
I'd love to start with a reading from the book. This is quite early in the book. Could you tell us what we need to know before the reading starts and then
okay.
Just take it away?
Well, this is Sam Brown. He's 31 years old. He's a nurse and he lives with his adoptive father in Joshua Tree. And right here where I'm about to read, his mother was killed 16 years ago, and the man who is about to be, the man who killed her is about to be released from prison. And so he's at a state of mind where he just needs to get out of his hometown and take off. And here he is at the cockfights with his girlfriend, who's a stripper, and he's kind of in a dead-end relationship with her. And it's just sort of, this kind of shows his state of mind of where he needs to just get away from it all. Here at the cockfights, waiting on a girlfriend his mother may have been kind not to judge, Sam thinks of any opportunity for escape. He calls to her in his head, waits for a response, but she only speaks in his dreams. The low rumbling around the ring reverberates. As he tries listening, tries feeling his mother's presence in places he knows she never would have been, his stomach rolls and tightens with disbelief. He could never accept that she brought on her own death. Excitement rises in the warehouse. Sam's hair stiffen. The strong, dank must smothers. It is the rank high of gambling, the alchemic thrill of money, violence, and strange bodies packed close together. Fools, he says under his breath. At last Haley returns as the handlers secure the blades to the steel spurs of each bird. Towering over Sam in her zebra-striped heels and frank, brief clothes of pink and peach tones, she holds a bag of nuts. Her long neck beer is already open and drooling. She pulls a can of soda from her big denim bag, heavy with a fat September Vogue. The strap indents her bony shoulder. Here, she says, her voice husky. Sam's furrowed brow forms a hood. He concentrates on the cocks so hard he could claim he doesn't hear her. She lays the coal can against her forehead. Both glisten with sweat. She leans against him. Sam stares at the pit until she shoves the soda at him. Her blunt chin-length orange hair glows, casting a science fiction amber hue to the tan of her otherwise white skin. You should have bet on the red one, she says. I should have bet on the black one, Sam answers. He pops open the can, catching the overflow fizz with his tongue. It stings with a cut when the bulky guy on his left bumps into him. Sam tastes the iron of blood and waits for an apology that doesn't happen.
That's a reading from the new book Heat Signature, recently published by my guest Lisa Teasley. She's in Sacramento today for a signing this evening. Lisa, the passage in the book is just bubbling over with description and details of these people. How do you come up with all these details of these people that exist in your mind?
Well, Sam came to me when I was staying in Joshua Tree, and I actually imagined that he was living with his father in the desert, and I thought the entire story was going to take place there. But then I realized that he had only lived with this father for a short time. I mean, that he wasn't his blood father. And so then when I, you know, as I went on the journey of trying to figure out who he was, I discovered that his mother had been murdered. And so then had to figure out, you know, what had happened to her as well. And so then this story became about almost all of California, because his mother lived in San Diego, and that was where the murder takes place. And Sam takes to the road from Joshua Tree and goes to the coast and drives up the California coast, which is just, to me, one of the most beautiful places in the world. I mean, I have to drive up Highway 1 at least once a year. And there he has a series of adventures, mostly with women, but unwittingly these people all kind of give him clues as to what had happened to his mother, what her life was about and what her death was some years ago.
I especially like in the reading, the paragraph describing Haley, and there's just so many details and I can see her so clearly. Where did you get her from? Did you look around and see people just like this, or did this come entirely from your imagination?
Well, I guess, you know, I mean, I have to say that she would have come from my imagination, but to me, it almost, writing is kind of a process of, a cathartic process of, it's almost like being possessed with characters, where you feel like your job is to find the truth of what happened to them. It's not so much about manipulating who they are or seeing someone and then saying, well, this person would fit into this narrative or this is the type that I need for this story. For me, it's more just a character comes to me and then I go through a process of trying to discover who he is. And then the other characters in his life just appear as I'm on this journey of discovery with him.
Have you been to a cockfight?
No, I haven't been to a cockfight. I've seen them on television and read about many cockfights, and I think they're still legal in New Mexico and one other state in this country.
But not where these people are.
But not where they are. No, not in California.
Why did you decide to make Sam a nurse?
Well, because Sam is that's a nurturing kind of vocation, and because he was left at the age of 15, I mean, his mother was taken from him in such a violent manner. And although her boyfriend Joe, who is who he still lives with, is a very caring man, I feel that Sam felt like he needed to be in a job where he helped people get through their illness, their misery, because he felt that that's what he needed.
One of the scenes in the book takes place at the Henry Miller Library in Big Sur. You've already talked about Big Sur. You like it. And I notice on your itinerary that the Henry Miller Library is on your book tour.
Right.
Is that a coincidence?
I was there. No, it's not a coincidence. I've been there. I went there with my very first book, Glow in the Dark. And there's a story in Glow in the Dark called Nepenthe, which is right there as well. And so then they had me there to read. And then because there's a scene in Heat Signature, in this book, with Sam meets a woman at the Henry Miller Library, it was only appropriate to go there and read. And so I did on Saturday afternoon. It was wonderful.
It's a wonderful place, the Henry Miller Library. I recommend it to anyone who's in the area. What do you like so much about Big Sur?
Big Sur is just the most dramatic coastline. I mean, it's just a magnificent view. And I was actually staying at the director's house of the Henry Miller Library for the reading, and he lives deep in the woods, and you could see the stars, you could see the Milky Way. I mean, since I'm from Los Angeles, I mean, that's a rare sight for me to see, you know, the sky just studded with stars. And so, I mean, it's just the loveliest place.
When I was reading reviews of your work, the word noir crops up a lot. Does that make sense to you? Do you enjoy noir as an artistic genre, film and so on?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, I would say that, one of my favorite noir films would be Devil in a Blue Dress and Chinatown. But then as far as writers are concerned, I actually don't read that much noir. I tend to read literary fiction, but there are writers, quote unquote, literary writers such as Joan Didion who write noir fiction. And it's somewhat of a California heritage. I mean, we have Nathaniel West, Raymond Chandler, you know, so many writers, they're kind of, come to the dark side of California as well as, you know, kind of the glitzy side. You know, we have both here. Like we were just talking about Big Sur, which is definitely like one of the most beautiful places in the state.
Yes.
And then we have, you know, the underbelly of as we have anywhere, really. You know, there's always the dark side.
What's your
our natures.
What's your favorite kind of book or I shouldn't say book. What's your favorite kind of thing to read?
Well, one of my favorite writers is Thomas Bernhard, the Austrian writer who he tends to write about from the point of view of a writer or a philosopher or a classical musician, and who is going through this struggle of the city versus the country, and he has this terrific sense of just our neuroses as human beings. Again, that the light and the dark. Our struggles with good and evil, and how do we behave? You know, how do we police our own actions and thoughts even? And so he's just one of my favorites. I think he really understands human nature, and that's what I consider myself as a writer, a student of human nature, and I'm just trying to get to the truth of our beauty and our ugliness.
Lisa Teasley's new book is Heat Signature. It's a novel. Lisa, your first book was a collection of short stories, and then you wrote two novels, including
right.
this one. Do you plan to write more short stories?
I am always actually writing short stories as well. It's a terrific way just to keep your muscle toned in terms of, I mean, the story has to be very tight in just a manner of maybe from 2 pages to, say, 13, 14 pages, you have to understand an entire world, you know, the characters, the setting, what the conflict is. And so short stories are, to me, a beautiful way of understanding our world in a slice of life.
Well, short stories are, of course, an important genre of, mm-hmm. of literature. Still, was that a good way to get yourself in the position to write your first published novel?
Well, I actually... I've always considered myself a writer from the time I was a little kid. I was the kind of kid who picked up a pen and pencil and I would write stories and illustrate them and, you know, staple them together because the library was my whole world. I would go there, check out 10 books a week. You know, I was a complete bookworm. And I just love that you could travel anywhere in the world, be inside of anyone's mind between the pages of a book. And I just wanted to be in that conversation as well, be one of those creators, one of those communicators, one of the storytellers in the world, you know.
Yes.
So, you know, just giving and receiving stories.
In Heat Signature, Sam heads north to Oregon. And in your first novel, it's about a couple that meets up in Anchorage.
Yes.
Have you spent time up in the Northwest? And of course, Alaska is very Northwest.
Yes, actually, I went to, with Glow in the Dark, I went to read in Anchorage at the Barnes & Noble there. And I'd already known that I was writing a book about a woman in Alaska. And again, I thought that that's what the entire story was. But then it turned out that she was actually from Los Angeles and that she met a man from South Florida. And so then when I was in South Florida on tour with Glow in the Dark, I did research as well there to figure out who he was. And then so they meet up in Alaska, but the book also goes to South Florida and California as well.
I see that you're doing or have done, correct me which which it is work for the BBC, hosting a documentary. Yes. Is that something you're going to do or you have done?
I have done. It aired in the UK a couple of weeks ago, and it will air here in October. They contacted me in February to say that they were putting together a new series on America called American Visions, and that they wanted me to go to a high school in Atlanta and just follow these students up to prom, and just because the Brits don't have prom, they don't understand what this rite of passage is. And so it was my job to go and interview these kids and kind of explain in this documentary what prom means to Americans and why we do this.
Why did they choose you?
You know, I don't really know how they came to choose. They Googled me and just they had read some of the stories in Glow in the Dark. And they chose the New Yorker's Adam Gopnik to do New York's art scene. And they chose Pulitzer Prize winning Charlie the Duff to go to a gated community in Los Angeles and discover what all that is about. And so so the whole series, you know, features a lot of interesting writers as the storyteller, and to you know, take the British on a journey into what America is.
Sounds like an interesting job.
Yes, absolutely. It was fantastic fun.
Do you want to do more TV, or was that just an unusual detour?
It was an unusual detour. Sure, I would do more television. I mean, it was a very interesting experience, but I'm primarily a fiction writer, and I always will be. It's just, I just feel privileged to have been asked to do the job.
You just started your book tour, but you're going to be on the road for 2 months?
I will be on the road for two
Goodness
months,
me.
Yes, going all over.
That's a big deal.
Yes.
And you're going to be on Ed Gordon's NPR show, News and Notes, in a couple of weeks.
Yes, that's right.
We'll be listening out for you then.
Great.
Finally, Lisa, what are you working on now?
I'm working on a story about a Mescalero Apache cowboy in New Mexico, working on a ranch. And so, again, I'm on a journey of discovery as to who he is and who all the people are in his life.
Lisa Teasley is signing books this evening at 6 at Underground Books in Sacramento. There are more details at capradio.org/insight. Also, a link to more information in general about Lisa. Lisa Teasley, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, you often hear how similar chimps and humans are genetically, but some parts of the human genome have raced ahead. A Davis researcher helped uncover one. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Ever wonder how we manage to cover so many topics and book so many guests on Insight? Interns are a big reason. You'll find details at capradio.org/insight. As we all know, there are many, many similarities between the genomes, the genes of both humans and chimpanzees. But there are some parts where the genomes diverge, and researchers are looking into that. One scientist who works at UC Davis was involved in an examination of a particular part of the human genome. It's called the Human Accelerated Region 1, and that's where there's a big difference between it and the chimpanzees. We'll find out more about that and what it means for research into how humans have evolved with Catherine Pollard, who's an assistant professor at the UC Davis Genome Center and the Department of Statistics. Katie, welcome to Insight.
Hi, Jeffrey.
Well, tell us what your research was about. What was your contribution to this to this study?
Well, the project started about 3 years ago when I was involved with the international team that sequenced the chimpanzee genome and did sort of an initial analysis comparing chimp and human. And that group was really focused on parts of the genome that make proteins, partially because that's what we understand a lot better. Proteins are the sort of workhorses of the cell. they do a lot of the things that need to get done in our bodies. And so that's a natural place to look for differences between chimps and humans. But what was found just didn't explain all of the differences. There's obviously a lot more. And what's been coming to light more recently is that you need to look at the whole genome, all the DNA, and include the regions that people might think of as junk DNA, because some of those are actually controlling genes and turning them on and off. And some of them, like this human accelerated region, are a special kind of gene called an RNA gene. It doesn't encode a protein.
Yes. And you were not at UC Davis at that time. You were at UC Santa Cruz?
That's right. This work was done when I was a postdoctoral research in the lab of Dr. David Hausler at UC Santa Cruz.
You said that you were involved in the sequencing of the chimp genome, the chimpanzee genome. Give us a simple description of what that means. What does it mean to sequence a genome?
Right. So actually, to clarify, I was involved in the analysis and sort of putting all the data together, but there was a huge team, more than 50 people internationally, and literally you just chop up the genome into pieces, and different labs around the world take a piece. And they do molecular biology, and they determine the sequences of A's, C's, T's, and G's, those nucleotides that we call bases or sites that encode all of our genetic information. So each lab takes some pieces and works on those pieces, and then people who work on computers, like me, try to put all the pieces together and attach them correctly end to end so that you get a big, long sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's that's the entire genome, all the chromosomes.
You said that the genome is chopped up and divided among people in many countries.
Yeah.
That it must be quite complicated to keep all that moving in one direction.
Yeah, that's true. This has been the paradigm in the sequencing of the human genome and more recently the rodent genomes, the dog genome. And it's basically because one lab doesn't have enough throughput to do the whole thing. But it does add another level of complexity because you need to put all the data back together. This may change in the future, but this is the current paradigm for sequencing a genome. And it still takes several years to do it, even with 50 different groups working on it.
And to help us better understand the research you were working on, could you give us a simple description of what a genome is?
Sure. The genome is all of our chromosomes, and our chromosomes are structures that are sitting inside each one of the cells in our bodies, and each of them contains part of our genetic code, the information that gets passed down from parent to child that tells how to make a human.
The research you were working on was looking for the pieces of the human DNA that have undergone the most change since the ancestors of the humans and the chimpanzees diverged. How do you find in this enormous genome the parts that have changed the most? That must be an enormous task to compare both these genomes.
That's right. Even though our genomes are 98.5% identical, so almost entirely identical, it's still a vast amount of data to search. There are still 29 million letters that are different between a chimp and a human, where a chimp might have an A and a human might have a G, for example. So even though it's a small percentage of our entire genetic code, it's still a vast amount of data. And so the approach that I took, because I didn't want to just focus on genes, which would narrow down the search, I wanted to really look at the whole genome and consider some of these regions that aren't necessarily making proteins. I developed computer algorithms for comparing the genomes, and in fact, I didn't just look at chimp and human. I also looked at other species, other animals, because the goal was to find pieces of DNA where the sequence in a chimp is very similar to all the other animals, and the human is different. And that's unique. In most places, the chimp and human look more like each other than a chimp looks like a mouse, for example. So I looked for regions where the chimp looked more like a mouse than it did like a human. And in fact, there aren't very many, but they're pretty interesting.
Can you tell us what percentage of the human genome fits into that category, where it has evolved significantly beyond both the chimps as well as other mammals?
It's way less than 1%. So I looked at the whole genome, and I only found a couple hundred regions that are each themselves only a couple hundred bases. So we're talking about a few thousand letters, and the whole genome is billions of bases, billions of letters. So it's a very small percentage, but if those changes are in the right place, they can make it a huge difference.
It's amazing to think that just a couple of hundred regions in such a massive thing as the human genome, being different from the chimp, can create such an enormous difference. How does that work?
One thing that we found was that these couple hundred regions tended to not be, as I mentioned, protein coding genes, but tended to be sequences that told genes where to go on, turn on and off. And if there's a sequence that changes its function a little bit between a chimp and a human, and its function is to control a whole bunch of other genes, just by changing that control region, you've changed when and where the different proteins are getting turned on and off in our bodies. And so by controlling one region, you can actually affect a whole bunch of different proteins. And in fact, you might affect a protein that then itself controls some other proteins. So the whole system in which proteins get made in our bodies, when and where it happens, is a very complex network. And if you can affect the input to that network, it downstream can have actually quite a large impact.
We think of protein as food. Why are proteins so important in this context? What are they doing?
That's right. Yeah, we think about nutrition, but proteins are really the workhorses in our body. That's a good way to think about it. They make little tiny molecular machines that do most of the things that we need to have done in our bodies. They move things around. They process the food that we eat. In fact, proteins process proteins, so we wouldn't be anywhere without them, which is part of why it's important to eat them in our diet, but they're a lot more than that.
So in the chimp genome, what's happening to the proteins there? The part of the genome that's different between the humans and the chimps, are the chimps also firing proteins as well, but just different proteins, or are they firing them in a different way?
I think that this is still an open question, but a hypothesis that's been around since the middle of the 1970s, in fact, a well-known geneticist, Mary Claire King, proposed in her dissertation when she was a student at UC Berkeley with Alan Wilson. She made a proposal based on pretty limited data at that time that the main differences between a chimp and a human would be explained by turning things on and off differently, but not by having different proteins. So our building blocks, the machines that we make in our body to do things, are the same, but we're just using them in different times in different places. And the more data keeps coming in, including our study, doesn't necessarily definitively prove that theory, but it's consistent with it. So we're beginning to think that this is, between closely related species, like a chimp and a human, this is the main difference, not major structural differences in the components in our bodies, but just using them in more different and creative ways.
Katie Pollard is assistant professor at the UC Davis Genome Center. She was part of an international team of researchers that was studying the parts of the human genome that are quite different from the chimpanzee genome. The results published in the August 17th issue of the journal Nature. Katie, the human accelerated region 1 was the standout, and you're quoted as saying that in the news release. Could you tell us what the human accelerated region 1 is and what made it stand out?
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that is the focus of this particular publication. This region stands out in a few ways. First of all, it is truly extreme in the sense of being very changed between a human and a chimp. In my scan for the regions of the human genome that have evolved the most since the chimp-human ancestor, it was by far the winner. If you look at this region, it's 118 letters of DNA, and if you compare a chicken and a chimpanzee, only 2 out of those 118 letters are different. But if you look at a human and a chimpanzee, 18 out of the 118 letters are different, so about 10%. And in genetic terms, that's incredible, almost unbelievable, that there would be that much change in only 5 million years, considering there are 310 million years back to the common ancestor of a chimp and a chicken. So human accelerated region 1 is extreme in the sense that it has really undergone massive reworking in our genome compared to all the other animals. It's also interesting because this piece of DNA lies in 2 overlapping genes, one of which is expressed in testes, and we don't know very much about it yet, but we've figured out quite a bit about the other gene, and it's very interesting. It's expressed in the brain while an embryo is developing inside its mother.
The fact that so much of the human and chimpanzee genome is the same, and you've just got this small portion that's different, and then this bit, the human accelerated region 1, is remarkably different. That would suggest that there's something profoundly important to humans in that part of our genome. Is that right?
That is right. The basic philosophy behind the project was to think about what happens to DNA that's not doing anything, what's the pieces of DNA that really are junk DNA. And if you were looking at a piece of true junk DNA that did nothing, you would expect to see less than one difference. You would be lucky to see even one difference between a chimp and a human. So the fact that there were 18 differences can't be explained by random processes. There must be something driving those changes. What exactly that is our future work.
Yes. I think when the average person thinks about genome research, they think about biologists and chemists and so on, but you're a statistician.
That's right, yeah. These days, people working in labs have a lot of new technologies available to them. For example, the technologies we were talking about sequencing genomes with, there are also technologies for finding out when proteins are getting made, when and where in the body. Suddenly, in about the last 10 years, there's been a huge increase in the amount of data that a molecular biologist working in a lab can collect. And the consequence is that a lot of people who are statisticians and computer scientists, typical sort of geeks, are getting involved in biology because there's a lot of data and there are a lot of interesting methodological problems for us to think about, and we get to work on some pretty cool stuff.
And finally, Katie, are you working on any more big genome projects?
My interest right now is really in understanding these chimp-human differences a little bit deeper, and also maybe trying to understand what makes primates different from other animals. So in the same way that I found a region that was very different between a chimp and a human, there might be other regions where chimp and human are the same, but we together are very different than other species, because a lot of what we think of as being sort of uniquely human, some of our intelligence, our social behaviors, some of those things are shared with a chimpanzee. So if I cast the net a little wider, I may actually find some interesting things as well.
Katie Pollard is assistant professor at the UC Davis Genome Center and the Department of Statistics. Katie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, it's not just computers that are vulnerable to hackers. A local scientist finds a surprising way to attack a cell phone via the web. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Sacramento High School was founded during the Gold Rush. On Friday, it celebrates its 150th birthday. Tomorrow in Insight, we'll look at the school's long history. Also, should exotic animals be used in performances? Experts will weigh in and tell you about pending California legislation that could impact performances. We all know by now that computers, when they're connected to the internet, are vulnerable to attacks of many kinds. You might also know that cell phones are vulnerable too. A computer security researcher at UC Davis is looking into just this issue, specifically a way that a cell phone could be attacked, attacking its battery. He's Dr. Hao Chen. He's assistant professor of computer science at UC Davis, and he joins us by phone from Baltimore, Maryland. Hao Chen, thanks for joining us.
Hi, glad to be here.
You just made a presentation, did you not?
Yes, we did. One of my students gave the presentation at the IEEE Securecom. That's a prestigious security research conference in Baltimore.
And is that why you did this research, because you were going to make this presentation?
It's the other way around. We do research anyway. That's part of my job. And we discovered this new vulnerability, and we thought that it would be a good idea for other security researchers to hear about it. So we came to this conference to present it.
Well, tell us what you found.
To summarize, what we discovered is that an attacker can drain a cell phone's battery surreptitiously in a few hours. So we did an experiment, and we were able to drain a cell phone's battery up to 22 times faster. So the shortest time that we got is that a cell phone's battery was drained in 5 hours, in comparison to the normal 156-hour, the normal usage time.
Now, why did you do this research? What gave you the idea to do it?
Well, it's an interesting idea because as a security researcher, I and my students are always looking at vulnerabilities in critical systems. And obviously, the cellular network is a critical information infrastructure. And it started as a student project in my graduate class on computer security. And my students wanted to look into this vulnerability, and I encouraged them to do it. And as we looked along, we discovered that the battery is a bottleneck and can be attacked.
So did you and your students create this kind of attack, or were you studying an attack that had already been done by someone else?
Well, we believe that we are the first group to discover this attack on cell phones' batteries. Although during the investigation, we have used existing techniques such as sending junk packets to the cell phone to achieve our attack. But the way of attack, we believe, is unique.
How do you, as a scientist, publish your research so that you can get feedback and review from your peers without making sensitive information known to hackers who could then presumably use it for their own purposes?
That's a very good question, and the general principle that that security researchers follow is that before you disclose the information to the public, you notify the people who are affected. So in our case, we notified the major cellular providers, and then we published this information to let other security researchers know. We think it's a good idea, and I think most security researchers believe that it's a good idea to let people know the vulnerabilities so that we can attract more research on these vulnerabilities.
What did the cell phone companies say when you told them about this?
They were surprised to know this vulnerabilities, and they told me that they were working on fixing it.
When did you tell them?
About a month ago.
Okay. Is that long enough for them to come up with a patch, a fix?
It's hard to tell. We haven't heard back from them since we told them. But I think they're working on it.
Do you think this is something that hackers somewhere in the world were also thinking about at the same time as you and your students?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The vulnerabilities are not that esoteric. If you take time to think about it, it's out there. You just need to find it, and it's not some secret things, because we are not part of a cellular company. All the information that we got are public information.
Tell us a bit more about how this attack would work on a cell phone, and in particular, what kind of cell phone would be vulnerable?
Any cell phone that can receive multimedia messages is vulnerable.
Does that include text messages?
That's more than text messages. So text messages are called SMS, simple text messages. But multimedia messages are the next version of text messages. So using multimedia messaging service, you can send the multimedia content, such as the PowerPoint presentation, audio files, or video files.
Okay.
So any cell phone that can receive multimedia messages is vulnerable to this attack. So the way you do this attack is the following. You send a notification message of multimedia content to the victim's cell phone. This would trick the victim's cell phone to make a connection to your attack server. And now your attack server knows something called the IP address of the victim's cell phone. So then your attacking server can periodically send junk data to the victim's cell phone to prevent it from going to sleep. And this would drain the battery very fast.
Now, why would someone do that?
It's a good question. Let me answer it this way. Whenever you want to shut down someone's cell phone at the most inopportune time, then this attack is for you. Think about the inopportune times, such as emergency response and rescue, military commanders in the field, or traveling executives in critical business negotiations, or even your friendly real estate agents bidding for offers. If you want to make the life of any of them more difficult, then you launch this attack.
Would this attack be difficult to do? It sounds like it might be difficult, that you'd have to have a fairly advanced computer expertise to do it. Is that right, though?
Not really. The two students who work with me on this attack are first-year PhD students at UC Davis. They are very good, but they didn't use esoteric knowledge to launch this attack. In fact, it's very easy to, once you know how to do this attack, they wrote a program with less than 100 lines of code, and they launched this attack using a home DSL connection. Although they only attacked our own cell phones as a proof of concept, but they calculated that if you use only a home DSL internet connection, you can attack around 5,000 cell phones at the same time.
Most of us are resigned now to all the problems and hassles that come with our computers and their internet connection. Do you see cell phones as being the next frontier?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's another reason why we wanted to present this research results as soon as possible. Because before this year or 2 years ago, most of the security researchers were focusing on the internet, because people have had this notion that because internet is open, so therefore anyone can look into it and discover vulnerabilities. Some people think that because the cellular network is closed, so even if there are vulnerabilities, it's not easy to find them because you can't look into it. But our research has indicated that that's not the case. We didn't even need to look into the cellular network, and yet we have discovered serious vulnerabilities.
Because a multimedia-capable cell phone has an IP address, as you said, which is basically a device's address on the Internet.
Yes. It's addressable from the internet. In fact, it doesn't have to be that way. So when we started this attack, we needed the cell phone to be addressable from the internet. But later on, we discovered that even if your cell phone is behind a firewall, we can still launch this attack.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Finally, how any advice for cell phone users?
If you want to avoid this attack, then the only safe thing to do is to turn off the multimedia messaging capability of your cell phone. However, there are two reasons why this is not ideal. First, it would be inconvenient for a lot of people. It's like saying, in order to avoid a car accident, you shouldn't drive. Another problem is that although we have to use the multimedia messaging services to drain the battery, it doesn't mean that this is the only way to drain battery. And currently, we're looking at if there are other ways you can drain a cell phone's battery without relying on the multimedia messaging service.
Hao Chen, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
That's Hao Chen, Assistant Professor of Computer Science at UC Davis. He joined us from Baltimore, Maryland, where he and his students were making a presentation on their findings about this stealth attack that can drain cell phone batteries. Next, a tough break for Zinn. This is Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Remember the campaign to make Zinfandel California's state wine? Just like the poppy is the state flower and the saber-toothed cat is the state fossil? Well, bad news for Zin this week, because Governor Schwarzenegger vetoed its bill. In fact, the bill had already watered down Zinfandel's proposed designation from state wine to historic wine. But even that presumption was too much for the governor, as it was for many in California's wine industry. The bill was written by State Senator Carol Migden of San Francisco. We talked about her Zinfandel campaign on Insight in March. One of our guests on that show returns to give us his thoughts on the latest news. It's nationally known wine expert G.M. Puch Puchalowski, president and owner of the University of Wine and chief judge at the California State Fair Wine Competition. Puch, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's a pleasure to be here.
Were you surprised that the governor said no?
Actually, I was surprised by that because, you know, usually in the legislature, once you've got the Dems and the Republicans all in order and everybody's okay, it's usually not a big deal for the governor to sign whatever happens to be on there for him to sign.
So what would you have done if you were the governor?
Well, I would have signed it. I would have been disappointed even signing it. You know, I was disappointed in the fact that the wine industry itself jumped on itself for not allowing or not making Zinfandel the state wine. I mean, I think any promotion you can give any wine has got to be good. So now that this thing's been shot out of the sky, now what? I mean, do we have anything to talk about? Jeffrey, will you ever be calling me again about Zinfandel? I mean, you know, I don't think so.
Yeah. Why not make wine California's state alcoholic beverage, rather than focusing on Zinfandel, which is important in California, but one of just many kinds of wines here?
You know, that probably sounds like it would be good, but I think as soon as you mention the word alcoholic beverage, you're going to get a whole lot of people out there that are going to object to that. And, you know, I don't think we want to really push the alcohol portion of a wine. So I'm not sure that would really work. And, you know, and also the other part of it is, it sounds a little generic to me. I mean, you know, okay, we're going to make wine this official alcoholic beverage of the state of California. Well, it's like making milk the official drink. I mean, you know, it's like, what does that do for you? I think picking out something like a Zinfandel, and frankly, I don't care if it wasn't Zinfandel. It could have been Pinot or Cab or anything for all I care. It's just nice to have something to hang a hat on and say, yeah, there we are, the official wine of California.
Yes.
You know, it just brings attention to something that, and I love bringing attention to wines in general. I think that's the positive part of it.
How could one make a case for Zinfandel being singled out as California's state wine?
Well, the fact that Zinfandel's not grown anyplace else. I mean, as far as I know, if it's grown anywhere else in the world besides where we think, you know, back in Eastern Europe or a little bit in Italy and places like that, you know, it's totally uniquely California. It seems to have gotten here in the 1800s, and it has thrived, and it's done a great job, and the type of wine that comes across, it's usually very fresh. It's a nice wine to eat with California cuisine, eat and drink with California cuisine. It's just a nice marriage, and I think it's just done a great job being here, and that more than anything would be a good reason to see it as a state wine.
Is there another California wine that's common in California that you could also make a case for?
I don't know. Thompson Sealess sort of jumps to my mind, but it doesn't make a very good wine. It's you know, it's the grape that's grown here. I don't think there's another grape that's unique enough. I mean, you know, any grape, Cabernet, Chardonnay, Merlot, these are all well-known, well-established grapes that are grown all over the world because they are supposedly the premium wines of the world. Zinfandel's never really been in that category with Chardonnays and Cabernets and Merlots. It's always sort of been its own little event, so to speak. And so that's what makes it so unique, that it's doing so well here.
What do you think about white Zin?
I love white Zin. I think white Zin's a wonderful thing, and you know, there are times when I will have a white Zin. I think people who enjoy white Zins, I say drink wines. I don't really care what wine you drink. I mean, eventually, if you know, most people who drink wines that have a little bit of a sweetness to it, and I'm not saying white Zin's sweet. I mean, white Zin may have 2%, 3% sugar. Heck, Coca-Cola's 45% sugar. I mean, Coca-Cola's sweet. I don't think 2 or 3 or 4% sugar in a wine is really considered sweet, but what it'll do is just get people drinking wines, and then the next step is maybe they'll try something a little drier or a little, you know, and I mean, that grows the business as far as I can see.
Finally, Pooch, is there anything coming in our direction in wine that will be the next big thing or that is going to fall out of favor?
I don't know about falling out of favor, but I see Syrah and Petite Syrah are two great varieties that continue to do very well. But what I really see happening, people seem to be going for blended wines. They may be Rhone blends or Italian blends. These are grapes that would normally grow in the Rhone region of France or the grapes that are grown in Italy. And we make them here in California and we blend them together. And people seem to be getting a big kick out of these type of wines. Of course, blending grapes goes back a long ways. I mean, farmers and back in the old days used to do what they call field blends, where they simply planted different grape varieties out in the field, then you just go pick everything and make a wine out of it. But but blending it by, you know, putting a couple grape varieties together and putting it together, it seems to be a trend that's going on.
Pooch, thanks so much again for joining us.
Anytime, Jeffrey. I love it.
That's Pooch Puchalowski, nationally known wine expert, president and owner of the University of Wine. Go to capradio.org/insight for a link. That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Our Insight staff includes technical director Mark Jones, assistant producer Jen Picard, and senior producer Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thank you for joining us. Sacramento High School was founded during the Gold Rush. On Friday, it celebrates its 150th birthday. Next time in Insight, you'll learn about the history of the school. Also, should exotic animals be used in performances? Experts weigh in and tell you about pending California legislation that could impact performances. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
That's tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.